It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Wars have casualties, and in trade wars, those casualties stretch from farm to table. The farm commodity that has been most prominently identified with the trade wars going on currently is soybeans. And so to explain the farmer's point of view of this whole trade war issue, I'm happy to welcome Ronnie Russell. Ronnie's a Missouri soybean farmer. He's an officer in his state and the National Soybean Association, and we're happy to have him on Farm to Table Talk. Welcome, Ronnie.
Well, I'm glad to be here with you today.
Well, glad to have you. And if you weren't talking to us right now, what's going on the farm these days? What's what stage are you with either planting or, you know, getting, what's happening late spring?
Well, I mean, we've had unusual weather here in Missouri, and some of your listeners may have, you know, heard on the news about some of the catastrophic flooding that occurred in Nebraska, Iowa, and northwest Missouri, and due to a lot of extra moisture we've had, which really began back in October. So we've been in a pretty rainy pattern, and so we're about 3 weeks behind what our normal planted acres would be right now, which primarily would be corn. Corn we generally plant first, generally around the first part of April. And there's some areas here in Missouri there hasn't been any corn planted so far, which, you know, some of them are even thinking about switching and planting soybeans, which can be planted a little bit later in the spring than what you normally would corn.
Well, so that does happen, doesn't it? I mean, when the season isn't going well, It makes you say, well, we can still get soybeans in because you can go in the ground later with soybeans and still hit a harvest.
Right, right. Well, you know, farmers are very dependent upon the seasons and the weather. We watch it very closely because, you know, that's what determines our livelihood. You know, whether it rains or whether we're in a drought or whether it's too wet or too dry, there's just so many things that affect what we do and also, you know, affects our ability to produce. I've always said that you can be a really good manager on your farm and do everything just about by the book. But that only amounts to maybe 20% of what your success is going to be, because the rest of it is determined by someone else who controls the weather. So that's kind of been a philosophy of mine.
Well, or somebody else that controls what the price is too.
Well, there you go. That's exactly right. That's the name of the show right now, isn't it?
Well, and in fact, that brings us back even to the trade issues, because the trade wars has already had an impact on soybean prices, has it not?
It's been tremendous. It really has. And, you know, the choice of words you use in there when you say trade war, which we use that, and the farmers out here, we're the ones in the trenches. Right. And that's just the way that it is. We are in the trenches trying to do all that we can. And we've seen such a dramatic drop in the prices of soybeans. And, you know, you mentioned about soybeans and the trade wars, and particularly I know a lot of the newscasts now are talking about the situation with China. And just a couple of numbers for your listeners to hear, which kind of puts it in perspective. Farmers have been the primary builders of that market in China over the years, because we have a program called the checkoff. So the checkoff means that for every bushel of soybeans that is sold in the United States, there's 0.5% of that value that is set aside for promotion of trade and uses for soybeans around the world. And a lot of that money, along with some other monies, have been utilized to develop those markets. And so if we go back to even, we'll say, 1990 would be a good point to start. China was importing about $400 million worth of soybeans from the United States. Now, of course, that's 1990 dollars. But in the last full year prior to these trade wars that we're having with China, they imported $14 billion worth of soybeans from the United States, which in turn, to put it in a better perspective, one out of every three rows that were produced in the United States were destined for a boat to go to China. And so when you lose 30% of your market almost overnight, it has a major impact on what you're doing on your farm, your profitability, what your future lies, your ability to plan for the future. And we saw a 25 to 27% decrease directly related to the trade situation with China. And so, you know, it's really tough. And, you know, I might add a little bit to that, too, before we go on. You know, we talk about on the news about it affecting soybean farmers. But the reality is it affects all rural America, especially those states that are growing soybeans, because those agriculture industries and farmers and the industries that go along with those in the rural settings, they're the ones who supply the taxes. They're the ones who buy the gasoline at the corner store. They're the ones who go to the grocery store and buy. They're the ones who maybe would purchase a different vehicle or a different piece of equipment. So this has got a long tail on it. It's not just affecting just the soybean farmers. It affects everybody that's involved in agriculture. And that includes the rural communities and the small businesses.
Well, when you develop that market, and I know the soybeans have done a great job over there, mm-hmm. and they have assessed themselves. So that's another investment that you've made as farmers, is you're putting in millions and millions of dollars out of farmers' pockets to develop that market in the first place. Mm-hmm. I do think there is some help available from MAP, the Market Access Program,
sure.
the Foreign Agricultural Service that you participate in. And for the commodities that help themselves, there's some funds available to put with your money to also develop the market.
Yeah, that's right. I kind of touched on that a while ago. There's been some other monies. When I met out of monies, that would be with that. It's called MAP, Market Access Program, Informed Market Development, FMD, mm-hmm. Along with the Foreign Ag Service. Those are monies that help develop those markets as well, which are federal monies. And we've always, as an American Soybean Association, we've always tried to get more of that money within the budget. We haven't been too successful at that, but we certainly would like to have more. I do know that an organization that was started as a branch out of the American Soybean Association back in the early 2000s was the United States Soybean Export Council, USEC is what its name is. And right now they've got major projects clear around the world and do an absolutely fabulous job in helping to establish new markets. And matter of fact, I just saw a statistic from the CEO of USEC, Jim Sutter is his name, Sutter. And we've actually increased in some areas of the world, particularly in the Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, in that area, we've increased market share by 56% of soybeans. Now, a lot of that is containers. They're purchasing containers, which could be meal or it could be whole soybeans. So, I mean, there's the philosophy that they're saying is do whatever it takes to make it. And that's what we're trying to do. So those are some other things that soybean farmers are directly supporting.
What share? What share of all the soybeans grown are exported?
About two-thirds.
Two-thirds?
Soybeans. Yeah, about two-thirds of them is the latest number, yeah. Well, now that was prior to the past year, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, South America right now is producing more soybeans than what the United States has been in the most recent years. But the major problem there is their infrastructure and their ability to readily get those out. And South America has to market their crop within a shorter period of time than the United States does, because they don't have the storage facilities that the United States does. You know, America pretty much is what they call the carrier of the commodity for the year, where we carry the grain. And that's a term that maybe a lot of people don't quite understand, but it means we have the ability to store grain and market it at a different time of the year. Whereas South America crop pretty much has to be marketed shortly after it's harvested. But I do know that China has invested heavily and continues to try to invest heavily in South American ports.
So
and even around the world.
If mm-hmm. they're putting a tariff on higher tariffs in retaliation to what we've put tariffs on for things coming from China, they're retaliating by putting additional duties onto soybeans that are coming into China. So whatever that difference is, I imagine people in the farmers in Brazil and Argentina are kind of happy because it makes theirs more competitive, doesn't it? Because it just...
Yeah, it is. It is kind of a twofold thing there. You know, when they add that tariff on to imported beans, but the reality is they really haven't been buying soybeans from the United States. And it's just a standard economic principle, you know, supply and demand. Mm-hmm. And when you have that demand shift away from America's soybeans, it causes the price to drop. And, you know, in my personal opinion, I don't think it's costing China anything on the soybean market because the prices have dropped more than the 25% that they would have to be paying in duties, you know, for those soybeans to be coming from the United States. But it is. It's a tariff that they do in retaliation, obviously, because of administrations putting tariffs on imported goods from China.
But their retaliation, though, they've mentioned soybeans specifically, but they're not putting, but they haven't put a specific duty on the soybeans from the United States going into China?
You know, I could be stand corrected, but I believe that they do. Mm-hmm. And I haven't heard the today's news. Mm-hmm. I do know that as of 12:01 last night, AM, the process was already moving forward for the United States to be moving from the 10%, which actually was going to begin at the beginning of the year. But if you recall, there was some talks and promising outlooks that there might be something settling with the Chinese. Mm-hmm. And so Trump postponed adding the additional up to 25% tariff on those other $200 billion worth of goods, thinking that maybe something might happen. And then, of course, you know, Sunday night he tweeted out that he didn't think things were moving fast enough, and so he wanted to go ahead and start the process of adding those tariffs onto that $200 billion worth of goods, which took into effect last night. But yeah, there's a duty that's collected on those, and likewise, there's a duty that's collected on goods from China coming into the United States. And it's my understanding that those duties that are paid actually go into they're going to the general revenue of the United States. My understanding.
Well, I think so too. I think.
And you know what bothers me about that is, and I know I'm being biased here, but I think somebody would have a hard time correcting me on it, but. You know, that money really belongs to those people who have suffered losses because of the trade war that's going on. And that doesn't mean just soybean farmers. That means a lot of different industries that have taken it on the nose because of this. And I, you know, I certainly understand what the administration is trying to do. You know, I'm not questioning at all there are some countries that just don't play quite fair when it comes to trade.
But that's been a long, old story with China. And,
it always has been.
Yeah, and everybody keeps saying, we're going to do a better job, we're going to get them into this trade group and that trade group, and we'd started working on TPP, mm-hmm. the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that was going to have 12 countries, and they thought that mm-hmm. was a good way to work them into the whole system and be playing fair, and then they pulled the plug on that, so that's not on the table. Now we find ourselves using trade wars instead.
Yeah, I mean, our administration feels like bilateral trade negotiations work better rather than grouping those together. But here we sit, and you know, we're not a part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership anymore, and still working with Japan and trying to get that settled out. You know, we're even still working on an agreement that all parties, that would be Mexico, Canada, United States, have agreed to, and I'm referring to. The United States, Mexico, and Canada agreement.
What used to be NAFTA?
Used to be NAFTA. Some people refer it as NAFTA 2.0, but it's USMCA, I believe, is what it's called now. And, you know, our biggest trading partners are right next door.
Yeah, Mexico and Canada.
And Canada. And but you know, again, you know, talking about how much is exported around the world. Well, you know, I believe the number is over 60%, but 30% of every row or every acre of bean that's grown in the United States was going to China. So, I mean, I feel like maybe you've heard the old adage about putting all your eggs in one basket, you know, And maybe we did that to a certain degree, but China's got the world's largest livestock industry.
And is that what primarily the soybeans are going for? Is it primarily going to livestock feed in China?
It really is. I mean, a lot of people think, oh, they eat a lot of them. Well, they do consume more soybean-typed products than what we do, you know, in the Western world here. But the consumers of poultry and the swine are huge consumers of soybean meal. And China is a big importer of whole soybeans, and so they process those themselves and
turn it into soybean meal that's mixed with, I suppose, corn too. They're getting the protein from the soybeans into the ration for the hogs, cattle, and chickens.
That is correct. A very, very good source of protein, and they're the number one consumer domestically here in the United States of soybeans is the poultry industry, for the very same reasons, because of it being used as an additive within the feed.
I would have guessed pork would be bigger than.
Well, they're right up there too. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're very close, but the United States consumes a lot of poultry in various different forms. You
know? So, of the food consumed here, what percentage might be for human consumption, or I guess even fuel is a use too. So what's the non-animal feed share of the?
Well, I don't really have a hard number for you on that. I really don't. But I've been growing soybeans my entire farming career, and I still am amazed at the new uses that soybeans are being used for. I even believe. And not trying to promote any particular food chain, but there's a food chain that's got a better Whopper burger that's an all vegetable or plant-based protein that they're selling pretty big right here in Missouri, especially on the eastern side of the state over in St. Louis area. And it's called the Incredible Burger or something like that. So, I mean, I
got to jump in. I had one last night. I actually, it was by Carl's Jr. here in California, and they just announced their, I don't know what it was called. It's a non-burger or something or other, and there was a big promotion with it. And really couldn't tell much difference. And they say that their market that they're going for are not vegetarian. 95% of the people that are buying their product are not vegetarian. They eat meat. But they, you know, occasionally are interested in this. And like I said, it tasted good. I couldn't really tell much difference between that and a regular. They used to taste not so good. But they figured out how to make them juicy and really copying the normal meat.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are so many uses right now, all the way from a board-like product that people use for decks, car foam seats. Obviously, we use it for vegetable oils. Which also brings about the use of biodiesel, the use of soybean oil as a fuel, and you know, we're big promoters of that. It's a win-win situation for everybody involved in the biodiesel industry, because there's a lot of other things they use in biodiesel. You know, reused vegetable oils and some other things, but primarily with soybeans, you know, it's putting in different numbers, but, you know, considerably amount of more profit for soybean growers just due to the demand of biodiesel being used. And Missouri, matter of fact, it began right here in Missouri, the use of soybean oil for fuel. It was in it was a joint effort between the Missouri Soybean Association and the Missouri Soybean Merchandising Council, which handles our checkoff dollars, and the University of Missouri. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's the low carbon footprint that it has. It's certainly renewable. It's not a fossil fuel by any means, and it supports industry and supports jobs. So that's another big use for soybeans here domestically.
Ronnie, what's the price of soybeans today, and what would the price have been before all these trade issues came up?
Well, right now, I just looked just a little bit ago, my local cash price, if I have some soybeans I want to sell today that I harvested last fall, I can get just a little less than $7.60 for them per bushel. I went back and looked a year ago, here just a few days ago, what I could get for soybeans. And I looked back and I could get just over $10 a bushel local price. Now, that's not, you know, what Chicago Board of Trade price is, but that's mm-hmm. what our local price is. And it's all based upon transportation, where mm-hmm. it needs to go, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's called the basis. The difference between Chicago Board of Trade and what we're getting local is the spread or the basis. Mm-hmm. And so if you figure that out, you're looking somewhere around 24-25% difference. And I believe that's directly attributed to the trade war. Now, we know that, you know, we've had a couple of really good years of soybean production here in the United States. And again, back to, you know, the economic principles of supply and demand. You've got more supply and less demand, the price is going to go down. And that certainly has affected us. If you go back, say, 4 years ago, just off the top of my head, I'm thinking we probably are in the $12 to $13 range for soybeans.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the farmers' great ability to do what they do very well, mm-hmm. we've produced some really good crops, which has forced the prices down to into the $10 to $11 range. Mm-hmm. But then a little over a year ago, there started to be these rumors, you know, about trade problems, you know, and the market started reflecting that by going down. And then, you know, middle of the summer in July, when this finally all said, yeah, we've got a problem with China. If you look at a chart, you'll see how quickly soybeans crashed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been really, really tough on farmers who are already dealing with some low prices. And then you get another 25% drop in the price.
You know, it's hard for people to kind of relate to what that means. I mean, but when you talk about 25 to 30% drop, you think of somebody that maybe their family income is $60,000 a year, and all of a sudden they had to get by on $40,000 a year.
That's what it is.
That hurts.
Yeah, putting that, a good way to put it in perspective that way, you know, how many people do you know that they could go into their work and their boss calls them into the office and says, hey, man, you're great. You do a good job of what you're doing. We really appreciate it. You got an important job here. You're supplying a great, plentiful supply of food and fiber for us all. But I'm cutting your paycheck 25% and I'll see you tomorrow morning, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it feels like. And, you know, I'm very biased in what I do, because I do believe I have an important job. You know, when it comes down to the really important things that sustain life, mm-hmm. I believe that having something to eat is probably pretty much up there at the top. And I'm very proud to be a part of an industry that helps support that.
Well, Ronnie, one of the choices you've got is you still don't have all your corn in. You could put more corn in, and you could put wheat in and just cut back on soybeans. Might you do that?
It doesn't work quite that way. You know, those markets sometimes follow themselves. Corn's not a very good price either. And wheat has been following up and down, too. The markets aren't really good. And not only that, but you've got to have a rotation. To maintain sustainability on your farm, you just can't, you know, just switch gears and say, well, I'm going to plant more of this now because, well, wheat in this part of the country is planted in the fall season.
Corn is
planted, you know, in April, so you just can't switch gears like that. And, you know, in order to maintain good soil health and you have to have a rotational program. And, you know, even when we've had years where maybe beans were a little better than corn or corn was a little better than wheat, I've always maintained the same rotation. I've always planted basically about the same acres of every crop every year on different parcels of land, just to kind of rotate crops around. But It's a little more complicated than doing something like that.
Well, now,
you know what happened? If we could switch, and you know, that's what the market does. Matter of fact, I've heard talks about it now with a wet growing season. There is some talk that they're going to start planting more soybeans.
Mm-hmm.
And we may push the acres of soybeans to 90 million acres or more. Corn and soybeans basically are pretty close within the acres, you know, 88, 89, 90 million. But it looks like we may have more soybeans when in the intentions this winter were to plant more corn. But that's changed because of the weather.
So you just may be facing a year you don't make as much money as you maybe need.
Won't make any money.
Won't make any money.
Won't make any money. No. You know, and you say, well, why do you want to do it then? Well, if I don't do it, I lose more money. Uh-huh. But if I try to put out a crop, I'll lose less money. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I hear you.
Because, you know, and you hope that maybe something will change.
Yeah.
For me, you know, I'm not old by any means, but I've been farming for several years, and for those that are in my shoes, you start losing equity. You may have to sell some things that you normally would not sell, you know, some assets or something in order to keep things flowing and hope that it gets better.
That's well, you're probably not going to go buy a new tractor.
That's not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
And means that those people that make those green machines up in Moline, Illinois, are going to be laying some people off.
They are. And it's affected the ag industry, the farm machinery industry a lot. And, you know, not only has the lack of people buying, but the increased cost of steel has also been, you know, that was one of the initial reasons for the tariffs. It's you know, within the trade negotiation, it's called 232s. Okay, that's, I know I'm talking about something that's hard to understand, but that was the initial response was steel and aluminum. If you remember that a little over a year ago, China notoriously was continued to produce as much steel as they possibly could. There was an abundant supply surpluses, and they just kept producing it, which caused a lot of steel to be out there, which lowered the price of steel, which put it below production levels or for American steel companies. Okay. So they were going out of business.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they were driving them out of business because of the price. Well, we're kind of seeing that now within the commodities. Not that China's producing a lot of soybeans, but these low prices are going to be driving a lot of farmers out of business. But what I was going to say is the cost of machinery has gone up because of the added cost of steel and manufacturing those pieces of equipment. And we're at 10-year lows on soybean prices. You know, I don't know anybody in any kind of industry that would want to be paying 2019 cost for production, but only receiving what they would have received 10 years ago for the production. And that's what farmers are doing right now.
Well, and you've been forced to get bigger and bigger and bigger and have a lot more acreage and get bigger equipment. And I've heard that you can spend close to $1 million on a combine.
Well, on a cotton picker, you sure can. You know, they're about $750,000. You know, today's on the what I would consider an average size farm, you know,
mm-hmm.
whatever that may be, it may be 1,500, 2,000 acres. I don't know what the average would be. You know, when you look at the numbers and they talk about the number of farmers in the United States and the average acres, there's a lot of small acreage, small farms, but they produce a very small portion of the total. And, you know, there's talk about corporate farms. You know, over 90% of the corporate farms are family farms. They're owned by generations,
sure.
You know, grandpa came and settled and cleared the land and, you know, those kind of things. So corporate farm doesn't necessarily mean it's a, some kind of a big commercial farm that's, you know, disturbing the land and polluting and doing all that, because farmers don't do that. We just don't, you know, we're not going to tear up or pollute something that provides us a living, but, that's a whole nother conversation.
No, I hear you. And when you're looking at this, I was thinking about how you've got the crop, you don't have the income, you're not going to make money this year. Now, there was some sort of program that the administration came up with to distribute funds to farmers. I can't remember. How did that work? There was something that was supposed to make up for last year's impact of the trade war.
Right. It was called the Market Facilitation Program. And it had monies that were for not just soybean farmers, though soybeans got the lion's share of that, because soybeans were the ones who were receiving the largest impact. But there was a lot of different agriculture groups that they got different portions of that. And, you know, there were some complaints from people about that. And I was even asked questions, you know, say, well, you know, do you feel like it's right? Well, my response to that would be, I appreciate the administration's realization that this is a major impact on soybean farmers and that they're trying to find a way to help get us through these hard times. However, our standard answer, and my standard answer, is we want to be able to trade. We don't want tariffs. We do not want to receive money in the mailbox from some kind of a government program. We want to be able to go out there and do what we know we can do better than anybody else in the world. And we can be competitive with anybody else in the world. And if we overproduce on a particular crop, it will take care of itself. We'll grow less of it the next year. Mm-hmm. But that's what we want to be able to do. We want to be able to go out and get a reasonable price, not excessive, but a reasonable price and profit for what we're doing, which, as I said earlier, I think is a pretty important job.
Oh, it's really
when you have about 1.8% of the population that's growing food and fiber for 100% of the people, you know, we do a pretty good job at it. And we have been delegated. You know, the world, or I say the United States. As a matter of fact, our previous Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, he's from Iowa. He said this statement, and so I'll give him the quote and the credit for it. But he said that we in this country have delegated the production of the abundant food and fiber that we have, that any of us can go within a short distance of our home and have the largest selection of food in the world. We've delegated that to a relatively small portion of the population. Mm-hmm. And so that those people don't have to go out and spend their waking hours providing food for their own families, because we do it.
You know, though, the thing, and I've said that many times, and I agree with it, but what I run into more and more are people that saying, you know, I don't eat soybeans. And and so we're talking all about soybeans and maybe even about field corn. And, you know, in the case of corn, it's mostly you've got ethanol and you've got sweeteners and you've got all, you know, and their exports, but mostly feed grain and so forth. So you got these farmers that are on a program. And, of course, I'm in California where we have 350 different commodities, and mm-hmm. There aren't any in a farm program. And mm-hmm. and so some people that are listening to this that maybe didn't grow up on a farm or not from your part of the country, and they're going to just say, Ronnie, just stop growing those row crops. Why don't you grow carrots and Brussels sprouts and green beans and strawberries and things we eat?
Well, I guess that's that may be, and no offense intended, but maybe a simplistic way to look at it. But, you know, I understand, you know, what their perception may be on that. But soybeans do go into so many different crops. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I said earlier in our conversation, you know, the farmers are diversified. Matter of fact, I was talking to a friend of mine this morning who's also on the American Soybean Association board. He's from Wisconsin. And you talk about a crisis that has occurred in something that all of us consume sometime on the table is dairy products.
Yeah.
You know, the dairy industry, and my friend, he raises soybeans too, and he raises corn, mm-hmm. he raises alfalfa, and he's got a dairy herd, but he's selling out. You know, Wisconsin has lost thousands of dairies just within the past year. Yeah. It's just done.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the monies that we receive for soybeans in particular that do go into various types of consumer goods, in particular food, but also in like I said, products that resemble wood and some other things, a lot of things. I wish I had a list that I had in front of me that I could read.
I'll bet they could find that list on your association's website.
They could. They certainly could. American Soybean Association. Type that into your search engine and look it up. And I think that there is a link on there that shows uses and products of soybeans.
And I do
a remarkable crop.
I do need to ask you, I mean, you have a program of sorts. People are aware that, I don't know if it's primarily an insurance program, but there is some sort of a federal program, is there not, that soybeans participate in?
I don't know in particular what you're talking about. I mean, we have crop insurance.
Well, I guess that's basically it. What's covered in the Farm Bill? Because people have the image that the major row crops have protection as established in the Farm Bill.
Well,
subsidies,
we
it used to be.
Well, that, yeah, but we really haven't received any major types of subsidies for several years. I don't know what's going to happen now with the depressed prices.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's been a lot of criticism. When they talk about the Farm Bill, though, you've got to remember that, and I don't have the number in front of me, but it's close to about 80% of the Farm Bill doesn't have anything to do with farming.
Sure.
It has to do with SNAP programs.
Mm-hmm.
and assistance programs. They put it in within the Farm Bill, I guess, because it's about food. For those who maybe are less fortunate than what some of us are and have difficulty in trying to be able to have food on the table through those programs. So, but yes, there are some safety nets. You know, you mentioned a while ago about the market access program,
mm-hmm.
and for market development. That is part of the Farm Bill.
Mm-hmm.
But there are farm programs that are in there to help sustain farming, and that there's some criticism that some people have against those. But here's how I feel about it, because I'm on the farming end. You need to have a way to make farming take away the highs and the lows and sustain it. Because our country depends on agriculture,
mm-hmm.
and not just for the food, but for the industries that it provides. And so you can't have major fluctuations in the security of farming. And, you know, they did one time call it the Food Security Act. I wish they would still call it the Food Security Act.
Yep.
Because it provides a safety net that we don't have some kind of major catastrophe economically in this country, in the ag industry, and we're all trying to, aren't able to go down to that local grocery store and have the abundant supply that we do right now. So that's really what the farm program is about, is trying to maintain maintain a low. It can't get any lower than that.
So is there a guarantee, though, like right now, say that the price of soybeans is down close to $7 a bushel or $7.60 a bushel locally. Is there any kind of guarantee that you can get into insurance or otherwise to have protected you from that 30% decline from what the price used to be?
Well, not that much, no. What happens is on your insurance, crop insurance, which is all federal, risk management through the risk management, can't say the word, yeah. Risk management.
Mm-hmm.
There are prices that are selected two times in the year, a spring price and a fall price. And those are how they establish any kind of losses you may have on your farm. So let's say, and I'm just using round numbers here, let's say that the spring price last year was let's just say $10, okay? And you normally produce 50 bushel an acre of soybeans. Mm-hmm. But you had a bad crop, and so you're only going to get 10 bushel per acre. Well, that's going to trigger your crop insurance, because they're going to guarantee you $10 a bushel at a certain level of coverage, which you get the option to choose. You can choose 50% coverage. So in this case, if I had a 50% level coverage, at $10 a bushel, but I only raised 10, I'm guaranteed 25 because I normally raise 50. I know there's a lot of numbers that
sure,
are out.
Sure, sure, yeah.
And you know, that makes it a little simpler. So if I normally raise 50, but I'm insured at 50%, that means my guarantee is 25.
Do you have to pay for that insurance then?
Yes, you do. But it is subsidized. It is a subsidy. And that's part of that what I would say, food security, you know, part of the farm bill, to maintain our ability to continue doing what we do. And there's fewer and fewer of us every year. And you know, situations like we got now with the economics of farming, the young people don't want to farm. You know, there's very few of those that want to come in.
Well, I'm going to give you an opportunity to make a commercial. Why should people farm?
Why should people farm? Or why do people farm?
Well, I kind of get why do, but why should they go on ahead? I mean, it's not sounding very appealing. Not that you're not doing a good job of explaining it, but I think maybe we're doing too good a job of explaining it because I sit here and I've been around farmers my whole life, and then you think about all the things you have to go through, and how do you convince a young person that that's the career they should go into?
Well, you know, up front, when you get your education, when you're done with your education, whatever level that may be, you say, I think I want to be a farmer. It's not going to happen. It just can't happen. Economically, it cannot happen because you have so much investment. Just to earn a wage, what a lot of people earn working 5 days a week, you know, 8 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And they get insurance, too.
Right.
Farmers are self-insured. And so you just can't say, I'm going to do this. Now, there have been many people that have, but it's a struggle. I'm going to guarantee you they won't say it wasn't a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the people that are younger coming into farming are generations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mom and dad are getting older and son or daughter decide that, you know, I think I want to come in and step in and help out and be a part of this operation.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe for some, but one of the bigger driving forces in farmers doing what we do isn't because of the money we make. Farmers may be worth quite a bit of money when they're in the grave, but when they're living, it's not so. But there's a greater cause. There's a higher calling that I believe the farmers have in doing what they do. And being part of the land and seeing those baby calves born and planting a seed in the ground and see it multiply, you know, that's new money. You know, that's not transfer money. Somebody making a wage and paying somebody else to make a wage to somebody else to make a wage.
Mm-hmm.
This is something grown from one and multiplied. And so I don't know, there's a sense about being a farmer. It's not a job. It's a way of life. It's who you are. And I don't know any better way to explain it than that.
Well, I think you've explained it well. And I think, though, it also explains why there's so many people that are coming in from other professions and doing niches and doing local farm-to-table,
sure.
The fringe around Kansas City and St. Louis. There are places that have... can make a living for a family on 10 acres, but they work all the time and they've got, you know, specialty crops and they're working with chefs restaurants. But it's not, they like the idea of farming, but there's no way that they're going to get 2,000 acres of Missouri farmland for, how much is it an acre right now?
Well,
it's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. You know, it's a lot. It's, you know, $5,000 to $8,000 an acre.
Well, and then you got even rents, even you just rent them. The rents, cash rents are really high, too. So
it is.
And it's like you say, it's hard to see unless you've got a family connection that maybe they can help you get into the business. And we keep talking about how much older the farmers are getting. That's the average age is getting pretty close to 60.
Yeah, it's a little over 58. Sure is. And that's because we don't have the younger ones coming in to drop the average down.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, it'll all work out. It always has. You know, we're going through a major correction right now, and it hurts. I mean, it really hurts with the commodities the way that they are right now. And, you know, I've had so many people, when I get the opportunities to speak to people, like you're listening to this, So many of them want to try to turn it political.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about politics for me. It's not about supporting a particular candidate or person. It's about supporting my family.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the issue is. And, you know, so many people want to try to make it, you know, waiting for you to make a misstep and say something about the administration.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not what it is. It's about policy on that end. It's not about a person.
Well, it might not be about a person, but those policies can be good or bad policies. And I think that I don't know if the verdict is still out or the verdict's in on this approach, because it's the damage is pretty heavy. I mean, everybody starts off with saying, yeah, I agree that we got problems with China and we always had. But I think it's rightful to say, gee, is this the best approach? Can we do better? may be another way to get where we're trying to get.
I wish, and when I've had opportunity to speak to people in Washington, I've always said, you know, I feel like there would have been a more sensible way to go about this, because we're paying for this.
That's right.
We're paying for it. And I feel kind of hurt that because I feel like we're a political pawn,
yep,
in a trade war here.
Yeah.
And our livelihoods are at stake. And it makes it a pretty tough pill to swallow when somebody else can do that to you and you can't do anything about it. And something that you have spent years in building and developing can be taken away so quickly, and you're talking about generational farmers a while ago with kids coming on. You're putting a situation to where some of these farms may not continue.
That's right.
You know, and so what happens to that land? Well, who knows? Somebody else may farm it, or they may not. I mean, it's getting to that point. Who wants to do something that they can't make a profit at?
Well, and if you go through tough times, you get back to your home territory. I imagine right in your space, you're not going to go buy new equipment this
nope.
year. You're not. You probably aren't going to trade that pickup in. And mm-hmm. yet this year, you might wait another year for it. And enough people go through that in their communities, and pretty soon they all start feeling, even if they feel like they're miles away from being affected by China, they're not so much, because it starts coming home to roost. So,
hopefully, oh, it does.
Yeah. So hopefully it gets to a better space. Well,
I certainly hope.
Yeah, I would. So in wrapping up, and we know where we are right now. I mean, I think you make a really good point for people paying attention to what's going on and issues and decisions like trade. But do you get political to the point of encouraging people to express concerns and questions to their congressmen and senators or the administration? Is it a point where the local Chevy dealer can jump in and say, hey, you're hurting the farmers and it's hurting my business. Can you find another way to do this trade thing?
I certainly would encourage that as much as I possibly could, because the fact of the matter is that it does hurt them. It's hurting all of us in rural America, all the way from the corner restaurant to the automobile dealer, the farm machinery dealer, that's what drives our states. You know, agriculture is number one in Missouri, as it is in, I'll say, most states, even on the West Coast. You know, it's huge,
mm-hmm.
agriculture industry.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime that it hurts, it's got to have, like I said earlier, a long tail on it. It hurts. It's got a ripple effect to everybody downstream. It may not be as noticeable at the beginning, but in time it will be.
Yeah.
And I wish that the people listening would contact their congressional delegation, both the Senate and the Congress side, and any others that they can get a hold of, and say, you know, we've got to make some changes here, and try to do something a little bit differently. And again, not try to make it a political issue, or we're not bashing nobody here. That's not what it is. We need to find a sensible, more sensible solution. And again, I certainly understand what our administration's trying to do. And I know that China really hasn't played fair. And we've known that. And I wish that maybe some steps had been taken through the WTO or something to try to get this worked out. But the intellectual property thing is it's a big issue, too. Those are the 301 sections. I mentioned the 232s a while ago. But it just so happens to be that us soybean farmers in this country are in the crosshairs. Because if we're not number one, we're number two in the total imports into China. It kind of goes back and forth between the U.S. soybeans, or was anyway, and civilian aircraft. Mm-hmm. Were the largest two in China. Number three, was a surprise, is cotton,
mm-hmm.
and which is an agriculture product,
sure,
as well.
Sure, yeah. So. It's well, I tell you, there's a lot at stake, and you know, and I think we're glad that farmers like you are engaged and working through your associations. And I think thank you for donating your time. I know you don't get paid to be an officer, and well, you've got a farm to run. And it takes people like you to step up and say, I'm going to get involved in my association and try to do what's right for the whole industry. And I think there's a lot of people that owe you some thanks just for stepping up.
I appreciate you saying that, and the thanks is in hoping that, you know, what I do, or what I do within the associations that I'm a part of, the American Soybean Association and the Missouri Soybean Association, that, you know, this is what we do. We deal with policy, and no, we don't get paid for it at all, but we do get an opportunity to represent our industry and try to do what we can on the policy side, and this has certainly been one of those years. You know, I'll say this as we're kind of wrapping this up. I remember last summer when all of this kind of came down, and boy, the media was everywhere, and it was quite a frenzy because they were trying to get, you know, to talk to some soybean farmers. And I made some comments to them. I said, you know, in my 40-plus year career farming, I don't believe I've ever turned on the TV and heard all three major networks, four maybe now, their lead story was soybean farmers. Never my entire life.
I know.
But it happened. It happened last summer.
You know, I the same thing. I was thinking how we say that nobody's paying attention to farmers and the problems of farmers. And I think you probably don't want this award, but I'm going to give you the award as a soybean industry for being the number one commodity mentioned in the media all year long. There's nobody even close. And you've handled it well, too, because you certainly have today in our conversation. But I've seen other people, that other farmers that have been on the news programs and your association, and they've done a good job of explaining how you stand. But when you're in that position, I'm glad you can step up and speak out.
It's been a great learning thing for people that are very far removed from agriculture, you know, people on the East and West Coast and in between. Because in my mind, I'm thinking when they think about farmers, they think about the picture of American Gothic, if you know what I'm talking about. And that's not who we are. I mean, most of us nowadays are college educated. We use high-tech equipment, and we're not just a hayseed out here.
No, nope, really not at all. Well, listen, I really appreciate you taking the time to tell this story to us on Farm to Table Talk. Thank you, Ron.
I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.